I believe the land must be fairly redistributed. Fairly redistributed. Actually, I'm a victim of occupation of my grandfather's land somewhere.
The member wants you to pronounce yourself on the powers of the public protector, especially in relation to the Concord judgments.
So the public protector's office is established by section 181 and 182 of the Constitution.
What you are hearing took place in 2016 in Cape Town, South Africa. These are the voices of ad hoc committee members and candidates who participated in probably the longest interview marathon to be held by the legislative arm of the state. The occasion was the search for the country's next public protector, and the stage was the South African Parliament. After asking hundreds of questions to 14 applicants and almost 20 painstakingly long hours later, which culminated in a display of exhaustion as comically described by this media report,
from 7 a.m. in the morning to 3 a.m. the next morning, MPs grilled prospective candidates. And it wasn't long before the effects started to show. First, eyes became tired, and then they got heavy. And at times, it was best to give up the fight and catch a quick catnap.
Eventually, to find the person to head one of the most vital organs of the state, parliamentarians resolved a few weeks later.
Honourable members, the result of the division is as follows. Those in favour, 263. Those against, 79. And there's one abstention. Honourable members, order. The nomination of Advocate Busisiwe Joyce Mkwebane is accordingly agreed to in accordance with section 193(5), subsection BI of the Constitution.
But what led to this important process being quite transparent and appearing to be one of accountability? How did this event influence public participation in relation to leadership appointment processes in South Africa's public sector? These are some of the questions that I, as your host of this Corruption Watch podcast, hope to have answered. I am Melusi Ngala, Senior Researcher at Corruption Watch. Corruption Watch is a social justice anti-corruption organization based in Johannesburg, South Africa. We are part of the Transparency International global movement that has chapters in more than 100 countries. For more than 10 years, we have received complaints from members of the public, and these reports of corruption inform our activism. More importantly though, as we familiarize ourselves with the corruption issues experienced by South Africans from all walks of life, we also propose solutions in areas in which we believe anti-corruption laws, policies, and processes have to be improved. Aware that the country was about to embark on the appointment process of the fourth public protector since the dawn of democratic South Africa, the organization, noting the need for public participation in this key appointment, launched a campaign to make the public at large aware of the appointment process and the role that ordinary people must play in the decision that the National Assembly would vote on. Mbua Mzansi, loosely translated from Sesotho to mean Speak Up South Africa, was the name of the campaign that mainly called for transparency and public involvement in the appointment process of the public protector.
It started at the time when we thought about it was going to be a flagship campaign that only lasted for a few months and focused specifically on the public protector. But it's continued, and over a number of years, we've monitored different appointment processes, from presidential appointments to Chapter 9 appointments and other ministerial appointments, boards to state-owned enterprises, etc. And it's developed into a project that I think as an organization, we've had a meaningful contribution towards, that has set important precedent for how appointment processes should happen in a constitutional democracy.
That's Kavisha Pillay, head of stakeholder relations and campaigns at Corruption Watch. I'm talking to her in our Bromfontein offices. Pillay is one of the team members on the Bua Mzansi campaign.
What motivated us to start this campaign was when we were experiencing the last iteration of state capture, where leaders were appointed to very specific anti-corruption organizations or crime-fighting bodies, were individuals who were going to serve a political interest over a public interest. And we then realized that these appointment processes, many of them which happen in a public domain, and for example, parliamentary processes or presidential processes, can and should be transparent and must involve certain levels of public participation. And our hypothesis when we had just started was that if we improve the transparency and public participation around these appointment processes, we could ensure then that we have better equipped, more skilled, and more independent individuals with integrity appointed to these organizations and institutions.
The head of the Office of the Public Protector South Africa is one of several public appointment processes conducted by the legislature. PPSA is one of six Chapter 9 institutions that have oversight on a number of intricate functions of the country's constitutional and democratic order. However, Corruption Watch's call for openness and public involvement in appointment processes goes beyond these government institutions. As Pillay intimated, the organization also concerns itself with the appointment of board members to state-owned entities, law enforcement agencies such as the National Prosecuting Authority and the Independent Policing Investigative Directorate, as well as other public agencies. But let's take a step back to understand what public participation means. Because though it may have seemed straightforward to me, Mutlati Komote, one of Corruption Watch's legal researchers, provides a legal explanation of the term which builds on my basic understanding.
In terms of public participation, the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa actually notes that, for example, legislatures must facilitate public involvement or public participation in processes when undertaking any kind of lawmaking. This can be done through receiving petitions on particular matters from members of the public. This can be done through facilitating public involvement in legislative and other processes, such as when there's a bill, and this must be done in an open manner. In terms of public participation in a democratic society, we are then able to make written and or submissions to Parliament. For example, in processes such as when Chapter 9 institutions have appointment processes and they're trying to elect particular leaders, then we as members of the public are meant to actively engage in those processes.
Komote further says that the use of the phrase public involvement tends to be legalistic, as it appears in legal documents such as judgments. But in essence, public involvement and public participation can be used interchangeably. What we should note is that the terms speak to our activeness as citizens in official state processes. But why is it that this facet of democracy has such importance in South Africa?
So it's quite significant because of our history as a country because of apartheid. Not everyone in South Africa was able to participate adequately in the laws that were made. And so with our current democratic dispensation, it's been quite important for us because of what has happened with regards to state-owned entities and the mess that we're seeing there. Our public participation is meant to strengthen our democracy because it ensures that we have a right to have our voices heard and to participate in who occupies leadership roles. And the kind of caliber of those individuals who occupy those roles is quite important. There's been an erosion to some extent of public trust. And so when processes are open and members of the public are able to adequately engage, then we are able to rebuild that trust and also ensure again that the candidates that we have who occupy those positions are suitable in terms of any legislation that governs that particular entity or that chapter 9.
Hearing my colleague Gomode explaining the seriousness of public participation with regard to pre-1994 and post-1994 circumstances, I thought I should ask David Lewis, who currently serves as a member of the National Anti-Corruption Advisory Council, as to what he thinks are the social differences between the two eras.
The more pertinent comparison really is between the Zuma administration and the subsequent Ramaphosa administrations. The Zuma administration was not keen on public participation, and that was the era of state capture when public appointments and the lack of public participation in those appointments were made with the specific intent of enabling a state capture. And the lesson that we've learned from that is that we must demand participation in these processes, and the Ramaphosa administration has been much more open to that.
Thinking to myself that surely there are social attitudes that can be attributed to civil society actors of the apartheid era that are different to today's activists, I quizzed Lewis on this point further. He then stated that the advocacy groups of back then did not want to participate in legitimizing the apartheid regime.
The major emphasis was in getting rid of the pre-94 government rather than perfecting its appointment processes. Pre-94, we had an illegitimate government. From 94, the governments had been legitimate. Even in the Zuma administration, we were active in encouraging public participation in the making of public appointments. In fact, arguably our largest campaign around public participation, which was, arguably the campaign involving the appointment of the public protector, took place during the Zuma administration.
Would you not say socially, in terms of how people viewed their participation pre-1994, it was for the common purpose of dislodging the apartheid regime, whereas post-1994, their public participation is to build this country through legislation and appointment processes?
Yeah, no, I think that that's right. I mean, pre-94, we never tried to build the regime, as it were. We never tried to improve the practices of the apartheid regime. There were many people who felt that there should be no engagement with the apartheid regime whatsoever. There was very little. That's not to say that even if we had wanted, they would have permitted it. And so the principal emphasis was on removing it. And subsequent to that, the emphasis has been on, as you've said, building democratic practices within the regime.
There is a plurality of voices in civil society in this country, so one may wonder as to the role that an anti-corruption NGO plays and how it has contributed to the environment in the creation of fair, just and equal laws and processes. Pillay says what Bua Mzansi has brought into the space.
What we did when we came in was we created a broad public awareness about the role of these appointments, and we cemented this idea of public participation, that the public does have a say in who gets appointed into some of these important bodies. So we've been able to build on the good existing work that some of our partners have been doing. There's been some interesting highlights, and we've seen quite a bit of impact in this campaign over the last 7 years. During our interventions in 2016, we got the ad hoc committee who was responsible for the appointment process to publish all of the CVs of all of the candidates who applied for the role. They created windows for public participation where you could comment or object to certain candidates. And they ensured that civil society's voices were heard in that particular process. Now, some of those interventions weren't in place prior to our campaign. And what we've seen since then is a continuation of some of those processes. In the Auditor General's appointment process, where we had again intervened and asked for this process to be put in place around public participation and transparency, there was legal opinion that was sought by the committee. And the Parliamentary Legal Services opinion was that our proposals, in line with Parliament's constitutional obligations for public participation and transparency, and therefore the committee that was responsible for the appointment of the AG should then ensure that they implement some of Corruption Watch's recommendations.
It is remarkable for a non-profit to get society involved in participatory activity, given that appointment processes can be lengthy due to the several steps it takes before an appointment is approved. Here is Komote explaining the main aspects of public participation in appointment processes.
Normally what happens is there would be a call for nominations that is put out either through an advertisement in newspapers and on Parliament's website for a particular vacancy, either at a Chapter 9 institution or any other entity. Members of the public would then have an initial opportunity through that process to nominate people that they think would be suitable and qualified candidates. Nominations are very specific in the sense that the advertisements set out criteria for who would be deemed as a suitable person in terms of the legislation that governs that particular Chapter 9, for example. Thereafter, the portfolio committee would then receive those nominations, and then they would start having the shortlisting process. When they do shortlisting, it's quite open. Thereafter, the portfolio committee would then provide a list of shortlisted candidates, and members of the public would have an opportunity to then provide commentary on those shortlisted candidates. They are then called for interviews after the public has made commentary.
Governing these procedures is case law, the constitution, and policies.
We have the Doctors for Life case as a starting point, which spoke about the duty on lawmakers to facilitate public participation or public involvement, as they referred to it in that particular case. That case provided a definition of public involvement where legislatures are meant to take steps to actively engage with members of the public. The courts in that particular case had noted that the legislatures have a discretion in how they fulfill public participation and that it should be reasonable. So the courts were cautious about being quite restrictive to the legislatures. In terms of some of the key laws and policies, the Constitution in sections 59 and 72, quite importantly, sets out the fact that the legislatures must facilitate public involvement or public participation in its processes, especially when undertaking lawmaking. The Constitution then states that members of the public are meant to be involved in these processes and that these processes are meant to be conducted in an open manner. There's the public participation framework that also outlines what the 9 provincial legislatures and parliament are supposed to do in terms of facilitating adequate public participation.
There are instances when lawmakers can justifiably close off discussions to the public for national security reasons. However, Gomote says that Parliament should provide the reasons and adequate notice when this occurs. Aside from this being a potentially problematic limitation for a society that has little trust in its government, what other challenges are ordinary people experiencing in respect to participating in appointment processes?
The laws and policies that we currently have are not fully in sync with our social norms. For example, in South Africa, we have accessibility issues in terms of data, the fact that a lot of the legislatures are located in the city center, which then costs money for people to travel to. And so that also affects people's ability to participate in some of the processes. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw that the legislatures tried as much as possible to move some of its business to virtual platforms so that members of the public could still engage. There was some issues around that where members couldn't contribute to some of those meetings. Chats were closed on the YouTube channel. Parliament had its Parliament TV, but the Parliament TV is not currently accessible to everybody because of the platform where it's held. And one of the things that civil society organizations have always referred to is the fact that it should be ideally on SABC as the national television carrier, but that has not been the current practice. Just also noting that unless you are well versed with the legislation and unless you have an understanding of why these processes are important in terms of who gets nominated, shortlisted, and then appointed, it really creates quite a barrier because the language that is used tends to be technical. A lot of the discussions are held in English. Some people do not speak English as fluently. Also, the legislatures make use of newspapers to outline the criteria and advertisements for call for nominations. I think what's been really important to observe is the fact that a lot of people actually listen to community radio.
Speaking from the perspective of a former leader of Corruption Watch, Lewis lists various problems noted by civil society organizations in leadership appointment processes. He mostly laments the lack of uniformity in these processes.
Some involve Parliament. Some give a lot of power to parliamentary selection committees. Others don't give much power to them. Sometimes there is no parliamentary process involved at all. Notoriously, there are key appointments like the head of the NPA and the head of SAPS, for example, that don't involve any process whatsoever other than the president's decision. There are others that involve a parliamentary hearing process, but a ministerial decision-making process, as I think is the case with the head of IPED. So I think we need to standardize some of these processes. They needn't be identical across all elements.
But organizations experience problems too, as Gomote says. Initially, she gives an example of a problem that arose during the appointment processes of commissioners in the Commission of Gender Equality.
There was a form for providing input as members of the public on shortlisted candidates, and that form had a character limit, which is something that had not previously been done according to our understanding. And obviously that can possibly restrict public participation processes, because you should be able to adequately outline why a particular candidate is suitable or not suitable for occupying a particular role without the restrictions. Obviously, Parliament does receive quite a lot of contributions from members of the public when these processes are undertaken.
There is an example as well of the legislature not providing applicant information.
In the leadership appointment processes, access to information is sometimes withheld due to reasons relating to the Protection of Access to Information Act. We've had instances where we as civil society have had to fight for redacted versions of information on particular candidates, which was quite important for us to get access to, so that we knew who the people that parliamentarians and others were interviewing.
Drawing on the experience of the Corruption Watch team that has worked in this area for several years, Pillay discusses an insight that poses as a challenge if not addressed too.
A key lesson that's come to us in monitoring appointment processes, but particularly those that happen at a parliamentary perspective, is that members of parliament seem to not be required to objectively discharge their oversight mandate, and that they're often guided by their party line and not a public interest, and they face limited to no accountability for not exercising their role as public representatives. What that means is that you would be sitting with a pool of candidates where many of them meet not just the basic criteria, but far exceed the criteria that's been put on the table and would serve the public interest, that those candidates, if they don't meet a particular political ideology, would be discarded. That becomes quite unfortunate where in a lot of these institutions where you're looking for candidates who are meant to be independent, but the people who are appointing them, they represent a political line and a political affiliation.
Komote agrees with Pillay and goes on to express a notion that we are all too familiar with in terms of the mindsets that law and policymakers must adopt once in office.
As part of South Africa's participatory democracy, they're there to make decisions on behalf of the public and not on behalf of their parties. And I know that becomes quite difficult, but they are elected by the people and should be undertaking decisions that are good for people.
Beyond reminding politicians of their public duty, how else can the country mitigate against party political interests and ensure that we have the best possible persons appointed into these positions? Lewis believes that appointment processes across the board must be based on principles of transparency and accountability. With regards to the latter of these principles, he proposes multi-sectoral panels as vehicles to drive appointment processes.
I think we need to apply some very basic human resource profession type processes that all of us have had to go through in one way or another for doing the jobs that we've had to public appointments. I think that people with HR experience should be appointed to the committees that make the appointments. I think civil society leadership should be approached for participation in the selection committees. I obviously think there must be room made for sector specialists to participate in that. If you're appointing the head of a hospital or the head of a power station, obviously you want people with the appropriate experience on that selection committee. But I don't think that this is rocket science. Every day of the week, there are selection processes going on for high-level jobs, be it in the public sector or in the union movement or in civil society or in business. And I think those standard practices need to be particularly respected where appointments to key public sector posts are made. And I'm surprised that we haven't had changes in the law to make sure that these more transparent and standard appointment practices are made law now.
Do you think that NGOs, by their very nature, represent different values and interests, and so they shouldn't really concern themselves with whether they will be representing the views of diverse social groups in their participation of public processes or public appointments?
They do represent different interests, as we discovered, for example, in the Life Esidimeni case. Those were all NGOs.
Side note, the Life Esidimeni case is a tragedy in which the Gauteng government ended the contract of a healthcare provider instead of continuing with the service provider that the government has had for a very long time. Patients were sent to unskilled, ill-prepared, and under-resourced NGOs. Patients were physically abused, tied up, starved, and left to die. But of course, the NGOs made millions of rands.
So we're not by any means all angels. I think it's about sector specialization. Where the head of a hospital is concerned, I would like to see the health NGOs represented on a selection committee like that. I wouldn't think it would be important that Corruption Watch was necessarily on that. Where the head of the IPED or the NPA was concerned, I would think that Corruption Watch and maybe Open Secrets qualify as sector specialists in that area. And so I would include them rather than, say, Section 27, even though Section 27 may have an interest and an opinion. They would probably want to ask their opinion through one of the sector specialists that was actually represented on the selection committee.
Going back to the point of transparency, this is how Komote says it can be practiced.
In our opinion, a balance must be created between the right to privacy for people who are shortlisted for these particular appointments versus the public's right to information around the caliber of the individuals who will be occupying those positions. So information must be made public as much as possible on candidates in terms of their suitability. And vetting is quite important. Vetting takes lengthy periods of time. We've had instances and scenarios, for example, with 100 ESCOM employees, where people then occupy particular positions and have still not been vetted after occupying those positions for lengthy periods of time. And in an instance, we still continue to have state capture. It's quite important for us to strengthen those processes and ensure that adequate vetting takes place and that it's done as efficiently and effectively as possible.
Speaking on what the future plans for Corruption Watch are, Pillay talks about a legal matter that the organization is involved in. Corruption Watch is part of a case against Parliament regarding decisions it made in the appointment process of commissioners for the Commission of Gender Equality. Pillay says that Parliament did not release the resumes of candidates, even though they could have redacted personal information if compliance with the Protection of Personal Information Act was the reason.
So I think this litigation, if we are successful in that, would then rule out any type of ad hoc approaches of what information you put out. It may be able to help us to standardize how many days would be sufficient for meaningful public participation, etc. I also think that through these advocacy processes where we're looking at legislative amendments, some of the laws need to be beefed up in order to ensure that appointment processes are properly catered for. there's the IPED amendment bill that's currently with Parliament, and that's a really interesting bill. We intervened in the process to appoint the new executive director of IPED, as well as when the previous executive director's term was under review. Our suggestions and comments have found its way into the actual bill. A process that we've advocated for is now in the bill, and I think that that's important because it helps to just strengthen these processes, and it's not left up to the discretion of ministers and presidents about what works and what doesn't work. Similarly, I think with the NPA, there is an amendment bill that is currently on the table. And what we saw previously, I think it was during the Mbeki presidency, in the appointment of Vusi Pikoli as the National Director of Public Prosecutions. Vusi Pikoli talks about how this appointment process actually happened on a golf course. The appointment process, in comparison to Shamila Batoi, was a bit more robust, where there was calls for applications, there was the release of those CVs, there was transparency in the appointment process, in the interview. So we want to see more standardization, formalized processes, and that these aren't just politicians using their discretion to appoint friends.
So, as much as there are successes achieved since the inception of Bua Mzansi, there remains a great deal more to do. Fortunately, some of this work that remains finds expression in possible future laws. That said, we should at all times bear in mind the following five recommendations where leadership appointment processes are concerned.
Firstly,
relevant legislations need to provide guidance on fair and objective appointment processes as the country works towards having competent and capable persons.
Secondly,
multi-stakeholder structures should be established, similar to the models used in the appointments of the heads of the National Prosecuting Authority and the South African Revenue Services, for instance.
Thirdly,
all selection processes run by Parliament should be transparent, with all information of candidates, including supporting documents, made available. Additionally, Parliament should share the budget and expenditure related to appointments and ensure that interviews and deliberation processes are open and accessible to the public.
Fourthly,
candidates must be tested for integrity and ethics, as well as their skills and expertise, using clear, merit-based, and objective criteria.
And finally,
Parliament should ensure that the principle of public participation is a central tenet in parliamentary appointment processes. This allows for the public, as well as the employees of the various oversight institutions, to be apprised of the abilities and characteristics that the new appointee would bring to the job. Thank you for joining me on this edition of the Corruption Watch podcast. For more on our work, especially that which is related to leadership appointment processes, please visit our website at www.corruptionwatch.org.za. You can also contact us via email at info@corruptionwatch.org.za, or you can give us a call at 011-242-3900.
#My hands are clean.